Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Good, Justin. How are you?
Doing good. Tonight's episode is the Stephen Avery of New Zealand, I think. What do you think?
If you've been following the Stephen Avery case in the United States and you live overseas, perhaps you've heard of the Crewe murders, which are the murders of Harvey and Jeanette Crewe. Much like the Avery case, you have a suspect that the police have gone after and convicted, yet much of the public just doesn't believe it. They don't buy it. They don't buy the case against this suspect.
There's alleged planted evidence. There's bad witness testimony, all kinds of problems here.
Because this is a New Zealand case and Justin and I are in America, and we know that Americans have a tendency to butcher the pronunciations of words in other languages, we'll do our best.
Exactly.
Many of the words that are used over there are Maori words, and that's the best I can say it. The Crew Murders case. A local farmer named Len Demler, and this is on June 22nd of 1970 in Pukekaua, New Zealand, visits his daughter Jeanette Crew's home that she shares with her husband and their 18-month-old daughter, Rochelle. Well, he gets there, and neither Harvey nor Jeanette are there. Can't find them. But he does see his granddaughter, Rochelle, in her crib, and she's crying, and she's dirty.
No one's been changing her diaper, at least that day.
This will set off an investigation, of course, and suspects will arise, one of them being Arthur Allen Thomas, a local farmer. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's talk about this family and what led up to these murders.
Yep, yep.
Jeanette Lenore Crew was born to a farming family in February of 1940. She would be educated and become a teacher. The man she would meet and marry is David Harvey Crew, also known as Harvey, and he was a lifelong farmer. Before they got married, though, Harvey wanted to buy Heather Demler's half share of a 340-acre property and farmhouse that was left to them by their uncle, Uncle Howard Chanel, who was the brother of May Demler, which was Jeanette's mother. Property was in Pukekaua. In fact, it was right next to the Demler property. So a pretty good location for them. And Heather agreed. Both Jeanette and Harvey owned that property. They raised sheep and cows, and by all accounts, they were very successful. In December of 1968 is when Jeanette and Harvey welcome little Rochelle Janine into their lives. 18 months later, Joseph Moore and Ronald Wright, two different men, are contacting Len Demler, Jeanette's father. And both of them are saying, hey, we're trying to get a hold of your daughter and her husband, and we can't reach them.
These are friends or salespeople that are trying to get a hold of them. One of them was trying to pick up cattle or livestock from the farm.
Right. Len says, well, I guess I better go check it out. He didn't know it, but during that week, and we're talking, if this was on the 22nd, starting with the 18th, the local delivery man started dropping off items in the mornings. And then the following mornings, the items that he had dropped off would still be there. So
kind of get a time frame of when they stopped responding to the public.
Len Demler shows up to the property and he says that the kitchen and the porch lights are on and there's a lock on the back door that has a key in it. And according to him, that's normal. The key was often in the lock on the back door.
1970s, farm community, people are pretty open, don't lock their doors.
Well, Len enters the house and he notices that furniture has been moved. He sees blood stains on the floor. And then he finds Rochelle in her crib. Rochelle has sunken eyes. And it looks like she's been chewing on her nappies and on the top of her crib. So she's chewed away along the top of her crib, and she seems to be a bit upset. Now, Len Demler chooses to do something very odd here. He leaves the house without taking Rochelle, and he heads back to his home, and he calls Ronald Wright back. Now, Ronald Wright is the guy that was supposed to come and pick up some animals, some livestock.
He cancels. He says, don't go there.
But it takes about 15 minutes to hear back from Ronald. So he waits at the house until then. And he goes and gets Owen Priest to help him search for Jeanette and Harvey. Only he doesn't tell Owen about the blood stains or about anything maybe being criminal here.
He's gone into a house where his son and daughter-in-law are missing. There appears to be blood, possibly a struggle. There's blood smears. and an unattended baby. He leaves the baby, goes and calls a salesperson that was supposed to pick up livestock first, and then calls a friend?
Yeah, and an additional odd thing here is that he could have made these calls from the crew home.
I get it if he's freaked out being in the house and he doesn't want to make the calls there, but at least take the child. This is really weird. I don't have children, and if I walked into a house that appeared something wrong like that, I might pick up the child and call the police. That would be my first instinct, but maybe he thinks they left and he doesn't want to take their child and freak them out if they come home when their child's not there. But,
and my other thought was, if he didn't want to make the call from the crew home, is it because he didn't want to disturb any evidence? I don't know. That seems like a stretch.
Yeah, but he's not calling the police first. He's calling a sales rep, and then he's calling his friend to help him look for his son and daughter. That's
yes. Now, about 1:45 on June 22nd, Len returns with Owen to the property, and he retrieves Rochelle now. He will take her to the home of Barbara Willis so she can be looked after. And Owen calls the police to report that there's blood found in the crew's home and that the couple is missing.
So the father never even does the report. Somebody else makes the first report.
While Len heads off to take Rochelle somewhere, it's said that other people show up to the property because now they're hearing that something happened. So now you have people entering the property who are neighbors or just nosy people. At 3 o'clock, a constable arrives, but under orders from the senior sergeant, he'll have to wait an hour before the house and property are searched. Now, he did kind of do a quick walkthrough, but then after that, you know, he gets the call. He's told, hey, get out of there. Just make sure no one else is in there. Just stay there and wait for us to get there, which are his superiors. So the senior sergeant's letting him know, hey, just wait, just hold up. Now, the other big clue, aside from the blood, is that the dining room table is set and dinner had been served and apparently mostly eaten. It's as if they were able to have dinner and then maybe they finished and then something happened.
Since the baby was in the crib, we assume that they finished and put the baby away. And
Harvey was in his armchair, given that, and this is a little nasty, but his blood and some of his brain matter were on that armchair.
So finish dinner, go gets in his armchair to relax, have a cigar, whatever he does in his armchair.
An investigation is carried out and they collect fingerprints, blood samples. There's a search involving 80 law enforcement officers and as well as civilians. They search the property looking for Harvey and Jeanette. They can't find the couple, but a scientist from the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research analyzes the blood and brain matter, and he concludes that it must have been a piece of wood that was used to kill the couple, because he's looking at the blood stains, he's looking at the brain matter, and he thinks both of the crews must have been bludgeoned to death with a piece of wood, and then perhaps that piece of wood was thrown in the fireplace and burned up, because they also have a rug and a cushion that appears to have been burned up. And the fireplace has all kinds of ash and debris in it. On August 16th of 1970, two fishermen head down to the Waikato River and they see a body just floating in it. And it's wrapped in a duvet and tied with wire.
Fencing wire, like a galvanized steel wire.
And a pathologist will assist in the recovery of the body because these fishermen will go back and get some help. He observes that the woman, who ends up being identified later as Jeanette Crew, was shot once in the head and her jaw was broken and teeth have come out.
So possibly struck and then shot, or shot and jostled around.
Yeah, we'll get into what we think happened after a while, but one other thought I had was, I found it interesting that after the couple was murdered, that their bodies were put into the river. And I wonder if they had given any thought to the idea that maybe they were both tied to the axle to try and keep them underwater.
Jeanette broke free from it.
But the question would be, why would you get rid of them then, that passion? I mean, if they're already dead, you could just move on. I do know that it's quite often someone that knows you, if they murder you, they try to cover you with a blanket, or they try to...
They don't want to look at you.
Yeah, they don't want to look at you. So maybe they were hoping that the bodies would just not be found until they were well past their identifiable state.
And if somebody knows you and is trying to take possession of your farm or something like that, then they got to get rid of you, because if your bodies are there, they have more to work with to solve this crime.
They do think that decomposition could explain many of her teeth coming out of the jaw. But what this does do is that with the recovery of Jeanette, they can see that she was shot. That means that they weren't bludgeoned to death. Now, she was struck, but the bullet is what killed her. October 1970, upriver from where they found Jeanette, they find the body of Harvey Crewe, and he appeared to have been weighed down with a car axle.
He's been wrapped in fabric, and the same fencing wire is wrapped around him and around the axle.
And he, too, was shot in the head. Now, October figures to be a very key time in this entire case, because October 27th, 1970, is when a garden at the Crewe farm is searched for a third time. Remember, we already referenced Stephen Avery before. This is where you're going to start to see why we would say such a thing.
The parallels.
They discover a shell case 2 to 3 inches into the ground, and they will run tests on this shell casing, and they will tie this shell casing back to a man named Arthur Allen Thomas. Now, what's important about this is, all the way up to this point, we already went over how odd Len Demler's behavior was. I mean, leaving the child behind for, I mean, what amounted to 45 minutes to an hour while he went back to his house and called a guy who was supposed to pick up livestock to tell him not to come, and then go get a guy, a neighbor, and say, hey, come over to my daughter's house with me.
Up until this point, the father had been the prime suspect, or the primary focus had been on him.
Yeah, his behavior was odd. The best way to say it is, he didn't seem real upset.
No.
And so we've said it before, you can't always gauge someone's reaction and use that against them. It's tricky. Some people just aren't very good at showing emotion. But up to this point, they were focused on Len Demler, and this caused more issues for this investigation. At the time when they first started this, they decided, once they understood that there were shots fired, and that's what felled this couple, they started collecting weapons. They collected 64 different rifles and shotguns from people in the area. And they categorized them by, are these people who had pretty good access to the couple, knew them, were friends or family? Or were they just people who were within a certain radius of their farmhouse, 5 kilometers out? One of the people that they were checking with was Arthur Allen Thomas. His statements were taken, but they were not corroborated or investigated. And his rifle, despite looking like it could be a good match, was returned to him the day after they took it from him.
They were focused on Demler, not on Arthur.
And they didn't check out his statements. They didn't try to corroborate what he said.
His alibi.
Again, Len Demler was the primary suspect, and his behavior was odd. He certainly had access to that farm. It was next door to his. I know we're talking about, his farm was like 430 acres, and his daughter's property was sizable too, but he was the closest one to the property. For whatever reason, they just felt like maybe he did it. But now that we know the couple is shot, and they're running these tests on bullets, and they're checking forensically to see if the bullets that they recovered from the bodies could have been fired from any of the rifles they collected. Now they're starting to look and think, maybe Arthur Allen Thomas did it. Further on, they do some investigating on this axle that's found. And what do they find, Justin?
So many people own this axle that it was they go back to the 1950s, so 20 years prior to the murder, finding all the previous owners. They find parts of the axle that were welded off are still on his land, and the heaviest part of it is what they used to weigh down Harvey. And also, the fencing wire, the steel wire that they found, resembled pretty much the wire that they found on his farm too. So they collected wire from all these different farms, but the wire they found wrapped around Harvey and Jeanette closely matched wire on Arthur's farm.
And wasn't close at all to the other wire, or so they say.
Yeah. So we have this axle, this big piece of metal that they're tying back to his farm, this fencing wire. They also get jailhouse confessions during this time, but not during the investigation, but after they've arrested him, of people saying that, yeah, he told me that he killed them. And then they were killed with a .22 caliber rifle, and he owns one. And now they're saying, we found this cartridge, and it belongs to you. So open and shut case. It seems pretty straightforward. They say that Arthur had a previous romantic interest in Jeanette, and she rebuffed him, and he had held on to this jealousy and got obsessed with her. They also had prior incidents at their farm that Harvey and Jeanette did, where they had a break-in happen where only sentimental items to Jeanette were stolen. Nothing of real value, like monetary value, but things like jewelry and stuff that she owned. So they're like, well, that sounds like a slighted lover. But her and Arthur had never dated or had any romantic relationship. So obviously he was angry about this, and that's the motive they paint here. So he got jealous and he went over there and he shot these two. We also have another eyewitness, an eyewitness named Bruce Roddick, who happened to be working on a nearby farm. And he says he witnesses a woman pull up in a car, and she's out by the car in the driveway of the Cruz house. Now you put in the whole factor of, was the baby being taken care of for 5 days? Well, who would do that? Obviously the murderer, or an accomplice of the murderer. This man saying he saw a woman there 2 days before it was reported that they were missing. Everything points to Arthur.
And they do collect a lot of evidence on Arthur. They collect his rifle again. They collect a single .22 brass cartridge. They collect 14 .22 cartridges that are found in a glass jar. They also find a .22 long rifle ICI box, but the box doesn't contain the original ammunition. It contained .22 birdshot ammunition. They track down information about the batch number that's on the box, and it would have held .22 caliber long rifle cartridges with an 8 embossed on them. Although and this will come up, the ICI markings would have included an arrow design that the shell casing found in the garden did not.
Now, with all that, when I first went into this case, Aaron, I thought, this guy's guilty as hell.
Go through the list. What's pointing at Arthur Allen Thomas at this point?
Well, there's prior incidents at the farm. He lives close by, so is this a neighbor rivalry? If he had a romantic interest in Jeanette and was rebuffed, now he's pissed off and he's doing things to the farm. He's stealing things from Jeanette. We have an axle which belonged to him. He was a owner of this axle and he had discarded it, but his brothers will say, oh, someone took that axle 5 years prior. It wasn't on our property yet. He was a prior owner of this axle. This axle is used in the disposal of the bodies. The baling wire, the fencing wire, is a pretty good match for what he has. And then you have a .22 caliber cartridge shell found that they say comes from his gun, and they match up the hammer mark, and they say this is absolutely from him. You get a bunch of expert witnesses up there on the stand to say all this came from his place, and it's open and shut, right?
Now, you talked about the burglary, but there were some other incidents that happened as well. At one point, the house was set on fire, although they were able to extinguish that fire. And then later on, the barn was set on fire, and it actually burned to the ground.
Kind of serious stuff here.
Again, we're dealing with two suspects at this point. It's Len Demler, who is Jeanette's father. And then we have Arthur Allen Thomas, who may have been a slighted person who was interested in her. One of the times that there was a fire, Len Demler was actually with the couple somewhere else.
So he couldn't have set the fire.
He couldn't have set one of the fires for sure.
And also, if he wants the farm, if this is a property dispute between the father and the children, I don't know if he'd want to set fire to it unless he's trying to scare them off.
Well, months before the murders, Len's wife dies. She leaves her half of the Demler farm to her daughter, Jeanette. She and her husband, Harvey, have this farm next door to the Demler farm, and then she now owns half the Demler farm. So between the two farms, she and her husband, they have 3/4 of this now, and Len only has half of his own farm, at least in terms of ownership.
And Len is said to be in financial ruin.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's in ruin, but he had at least $10,000 worth of debt.
Which, 1970, that's a lot of money. $10,000 today, not so bad.
So there may be an issue there where he's upset with his daughter basically taking over the farms.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he would have access to this farm. He's basically next door.
And if he can expand his property, he can get more livestock, he can take their livestock, whatever, and make more money, because that's their whole livelihood.
And it might be another reason why Rochelle wasn't directly harmed, or the livestock, or even the dogs. Now, when they investigated these things, let's go over the baby real quick. The baby, again, had been chewing on wet nappies. She had been chewing on the cot that she was in. Her eyes looked sunken, and she was dirty. So she could have been left for 5 days. It's possible. But two pediatricians and a nurse all agreed that she had to have been taken care of somewhat, because they felt that she hadn't lost quite enough weight if she were left alone for 5 days. It just didn't make sense. They also said there appeared to be some evidence that her nappy had been changed during that time. So you put that together with the fact that the dogs looked very healthy.
Livestock looked taken care of.
It's very strange. Why would these things have to take place that way? If you were just coming to kill the couple, you wouldn't give a damn about their livestock or their dogs, would you?
Yeah, I mean, this is Hinterkaifeck, right? The murderer stayed on the property for a while. So,
well, that's just it. Did someone stay on the property? I don't know that anybody's saying they did, but it almost sounds like they're suggesting that they came by once in a while. Why would you revisit a crime scene unless you didn't suspect anybody would, you know,
discover it?
So we have our two suspects. Both of these men could visit the property. Len Demler was essentially next door. Arthur Allen Thomas lived 13 kilometers away. But, you know, he could visit.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Let's introduce the third suspect, this axehole that they say belonged to Arthur. There was a man who had worked on this axle and was pretty much the local maintenance and automotive guy, whatever, Rod Rasmussen. He describes cutting this axle from, you know, various vehicles or trailers and replacing it, but denies knowing about this axle. He never confesses to, yeah, I've worked on that and this is it. But Arthur's like, yeah, he's the one that cut it out and these are the cuts and this is the leftover parts that are on my farm that you're finding that match perfectly to this piece of metal that was found on Harvey's body. So Rasmussen is a factor now because he was kind of the last person to handle this axle.
And it doesn't just end there either, because Rod says that he finds three guns under a water tank. This was on his Caramandal batch, which is a beach house. One of the weapons was a .22 caliber. Now, he claims that he tries to give it to the police, but they don't seem very interested until a relative of his named Paul Jellick accuses Rasmussen and his wife of being involved in the murders and feeding the baby. So now we have another person saying, oh, I know who that woman was. It was Rasmussen's wife.
Rod will say he turned those weapons over to the police, but the police will have no record of this. They will not be able to find any interaction he had with the police, which if somebody's turning in a gun, you think that they would write down the serial numbers and stuff like that. So I would hope that that would be recorded.
So we have some suspects to look at. We've given you some background as to why they might be of interest, but we need to start focusing now on the main piece of evidence. Let's go through some of the other stuff too. I mean, the wiring, just like with hair now, you can say, yeah, this hair looks just like that hair, but is that really scientific?
And all these are farms. All of them use this wire. They took samples from 9 different farms, but it's kind of a small sample. But I'm assuming it's all farms that were within the general area. So why would somebody from very far away come over and do this? So we're back to the axle and, you know, they know that they were killed with a .22 caliber and they find this cartridge.
Well, on the axle, they're trying to tie it to Thomas because both he and his father have had possession of it. And they find the stubs from the axle buried on the farm tip. But they really can't prove that it wasn't taken away 5 years before.
Yeah, that's their alibi for the axle is we haven't seen this axle for 5 years. Some men took it away, but that's just hearsay. That's just them saying that happened.
But the police aren't able to prove that it definitely was on the farm and that he had access to this axle.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, even though they were able to trace it back about 2 decades, they can't trace it back to recent times.
But he can't prove that it wasn't there. All his, their whole stories, 5 men came and took it. Not these 5 men and give names. It's a very general story.
But who has to prove what?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get down to the most important piece of evidence in this entire case, which is Exhibit 350. It's the shell casing found in the garden.
It wasn't found after 2 searches. And these were very thorough searches. But if you know how large a 22 caliber shell is, it's rather small. And if this is in grass or if this is in some sort of roughage of some kind, you're not going to see it. So I can buy that they wouldn't have found this thing until many searches later. So two searches, and then they find it on the third.
Now, the reason why they say that the garden was searched for the third time was because on the 11th of October of 1970, a Detective Johnson is looking over photographic evidence, and he sees a spot outside the house from which a shooter could draw a bead on Harvey Crewe. And they say if you stand on this ledge near a window, not really a ledge, but it's kind of like a brick part of the house that comes off the house next to the window. If the shooter stood on that and pushed his rifle through an open window, that he could have taken aim at Harvey sitting in his armchair. And there is a photograph showing that, well, that's possible. And Harvey was shot in the chair. Okay, but we'll get into it later on how likely this is. October 26th, Inspector Bruce Hutton asked Sergeant Jeffries if the garden had been sieve searched back in August.
Sieve search meaning you take a very fine grate, you pull the dirt on it, and then you let the dirt and sediment go through, and it just leaves any larger objects, such as a bullet or shell.
And Jeffries replies, no, this is odd because some say it had been. By October 27th, police have already collected Arthur Thomas's rifle and cartridges identical to the shell casing found in the garden. October 27th just so happens to be the day that they search it again. They are trying to use a fork and a sieve. So they use a fork to loosen the ground, and then the other person sieves it. But the ground is too damp to use the sieve. They resort to using a fork and fingers method. And the two detectives, Charles and Parks, are the ones sieving. They're digging up and sieving. And somewhere between 11:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. that day, they find the shell casing buried 2 to 3 inches in the ground. Now, they pull this case out of the ground, and dry soil or dry mud comes out of it, which is odd because the whole ground is damp. It's muddy.
Yeah, why would it be dry inside and wet all everywhere else? It would just be wet everywhere.
Now, police say, you know, there was an experiment done to see whether this was possible, and they say that they were able to show, surprisingly, that you could have dried mud inside of a shell case if it was in damp soil. This area where they found the shell casing was 15 feet 10 inches from the wall where the window is in the farmhouse.
Which, if you're up on this brick stoop and you've shot a bullet through the window, Arthur's 22 caliber rifle was a pump action. So it ejects the shell. You're elevated. That makes sense. That's about where the shell casing would fall.
Yeah, that's what their reconstruction is what they say told them, hey, we should go look for the shell casing, if there is one, over in this area.
And this window that was shot through has multiple horizontal slats. You can open up the top slats and leave the bottom ones closed. And that's what you would have to do to shoot through the window, not leaving, you know, not breaking the glass with the gunshot. So that's their reconstruction of this.
But something curious happens, which will cause a major issue for this investigation later on.
Arthur Thomas will be charged, and his first trial is in 1971. He will be found guilty and sentenced. All of this evidence will come into question. The shell casing that's found, the axle, the wiring, all this stuff. And he will be granted a retrial in 1973. But same outcome. He is found guilty. Nobody in the courtroom thought that they could find him guilty again. They were absolutely convinced that it was obvious there was at least reasonable doubt. By the way, there's a movie called Reasonable Doubt out there about this. So Arthur will be pardoned in 1979. So he's exonerated. He's let out. He is given actually innocent status. They reward him with $950,000 in 1980. so a year after his pardon.
Which in today's money is about $4.5 million.
It's a lot of money. He was in prison for 9 years. So 9 years, $4.5 million. Some of you might say, hey, I'd spend 9 years in prison for $4.5 million, but let me tell you, you really wouldn't.
In December of 1979 is when he's pardoned, and the prison farm that he's at, the superintendent walks up to him and shakes his hand and says, I've got a Christmas present for you. You're pardoned. They said at first Arthur Thomas didn't believe him.
Well, yeah, he thought it was a joke.
I mean, he was convicted twice. You could understand his reluctance to believe such news. He said he felt like he was being treated like a human being again, because before that, he was a monster.
Double murderer, dispose of the bodies. Yeah. Let's talk about the problems with the reconstruction and this evidence. Because when I first heard about this case and I looked at the evidence, I'll tell you right now, I was like, this guy's guilty. I didn't even think, I'm like, I don't care what evidence they think. And a lot of them were pretty much based on this man was charged and convicted and found guilty on a single shell casing. And I thought, no, he wasn't. He was found guilty for a lot more than just a shell casing.
There was an axle. There was wire. There was the shell casing.
Jailhouse confessions. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot that looked bad for him.
This was in June, so their reconstruction says that Harvey was shot through a window. June in New Zealand is actually the winter time, or the colder months. Also, the ground was wet because it was raining. Why would they have their window open if it's cold and rainy out? The shooter would have to come up and open the window, shoot this man in his chair, and then run around to the other side of the house, gain access, and shoot Jeanette, who is standing there, not moving? Is this the case?
It just doesn't sound plausible. And I would urge anyone who's wondering about this whole reconstruction to look up the images from it. And you can see where the shooter would have had to have been and where Harvey would have had to have been.
It's an awkward place. I didn't think of it at first because it sounded very plausible, the prosecution's theory here. The more you look into it, the more you think, that's kind of weird. Unless this guy's like a ninja stealth guy trying to assassinate this couple, there's no reason why somebody would jump up on this stoop, take their first shot from outside, and then run around and do a finishing shot.
The way I see it is I think he may have been shot after his wife is struck, after Jeanette is struck, because I think Jeanette was struck and knocked down before anybody was shot. That's just my opinion. I could see it either way, but I almost feel like there was a threat going on there. And this person didn't need to shoot through a window. They didn't need to break in. The door had the key in the lock. Yeah. I mean, again, it's a farmhouse. This isn't modern times where people are more paranoid about locking up.
And being that the bodies were not at the crime scene, missing, had been disposed of in the river, we don't know the angle that they were shot in.
All we do know is we know that because of the blood and the brain matter on the chair that Harvey was sitting in the chair, we don't know which way his head was facing.
Yeah.
And we don't know, again, for sure whether the shooter was outside or not. We just find it unlikely that he was outside of the house at the time, because then he would have to run around and hope that Jeanette just stayed in that same room, not moving, because she was obviously killed right there in the room with Harvey.
I thought, okay, so it's possible that they planted this 22 caliber shell out in the garden, but I was still thinking, well, what about the axle? What about this wire? I don't care if they planted the shell. I mean, it's crappy if law enforcement's planting evidence, but we still have this axle. We still have this fencing wire. But then you take into account the wire is not a perfect match for anything. And when was the wire purchased? What length of wire did they cut from? It's not a perfect match. And then this axle, if you can find the owner of it, you can find the murderer. But they cannot prove that Arthur had this axle at the time of the murder. And he cannot prove he didn't have it. It's just his word against theirs. The only real thing tying him to this is this shell casing. Everything up until this point is hearsay. Oh, by the way, the jailhouse confession witness, very unreliable, and had said multiple people had confessed to things. They said that he was a total swindler, and there it is. It's like, was that a real jailhouse confession, or was that him trying to get less time, him trying to work with the prosecution? So you throw out the jailhouse confession from this other eyewitness.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
We're down to the casing, the cartridge.
As we said, it was found on the third search. Inspector Hutton had asked Sergeant Jeffries if the garden had been sieve searched. The reply was no. But this is very curious because Inspector Hutton should know because he looks through the reports.
He's the lead investigator. He's the one in charge of the investigation.
Right. And so if they had sieve searched it, that would have been in the report and he could have read it and he would know that. This little conversation happens the day before the search happens and the shell case is found. What else is problematic with this shell case?
The bullets that they recovered from Harvey and Jeanette had the number 8 stamped on the back, which means they came from a specific manufacturer, specific brand. Now, the shell casing they recovered from the garden happens to be the same brand of bullet, but from a different batch or category. So the one that was found in the garden was a category 4, but the bullets recovered from the victims would not have come from a category 4 shell. So this shell they found, they prove is from his rifle, but how could it have been used in the murder if the bullet that was shot from it doesn't match the batch and number? This all came out in a 1980 Royal Commission inquiry that says there's major missteps in this investigation. This shell actually does not tie him to the murder now, unless they planted it or they said it was found 2 to 3 inches deep in the dirt. What if it had been there for years and not had anything to do with the murder? But the shell was found in a location in the garden that was close to the window where their recreation, their reconstruction of this murder, puts the shooter at the window. This is the perfect spot for the recreation. But if the window shooting doesn't work, then this is the worst spot, you know, to plant evidence from a rifle.
Now, after it's found, of course, the shell casing is described by multiple people. It's described by Detectives Charles and Detective Parks. It's also described by the scientists from the Department of Scientific Industrial Research. All of them describe it very similarly, but Inspector Hutton describes it a little differently. He describes the shell casing as having an inky stain, which is precisely what you would see if there was corrosion on a shell casing.
Like it's been left out in the elements.
Exactly. That's something else that points to possible planting of evidence, because here you have the inspector saying, oh, I saw this on it. And yet the other people who looked at it, a scientist and two other detectives, didn't describe seeing an inky stain. So it's very suspicious.
Hutton is the only person that's describing it this way. If it's a clean, fresh shell, then it hasn't been sitting out there for months. Now, the other idea or theory here is that the shooter, or if we're presuming it's Arthur, is he had an empty shell loaded in his gun. And as he was walking up to the house, he racked the slide and ejected this shell and then walked into the house and fired different ammunition, or ammunition from a different batch from the same company, into the victims. That's pretty, I mean, why would he want to give away his location, racking the slide as he walks up to the house? Why would he have an empty shell or a spent shell in his gun walking to commit a murder? That just doesn't make sense. Why was the window open on a cold night? There's just a lot of problems with this recreation that's throwing the shell and the idea of how this went down all in question.
Investigative journalist Pat Booth, as well as a forensic scientist named Jim Sprott, are the ones that broke this shell case wide open. One of the, I guess you could say, the way that you could show that this was planted as well is that as of that October 27th date, the police had for about a week the Thomas rifle as well as ammunition that would have matched the shell casing that was found in the garden.
So they had access to all of Arthur's stuff, and they could have taken any of it and put it anywhere. And with the recreation of the shooter at the window, hey, just throw it there. Oh, now we found it.
And what's really bad about all this is this investigation was so poorly conducted that anywhere you look, whether it's the fingerprinting, statements by different witnesses, what have you, all of it was poorly recorded.
So on the fingerprinting, they collected all these fingerprints from the murder scene. They were not able to identify multiple fingerprints. I think it's up to 25. They didn't take fingerprints from Rasmussen. They didn't take fingerprints from any of the wives.
It just keeps getting worse. Seven vehicles were seen at the Crewe property between Wednesday and Monday of the week in question, but they weren't tied to individuals. So perhaps missed opportunities. If you saw a vehicle there,
like the woman that one guy saw, they never were able to identify her.
They could have at least gone to the different families in the area and checked out what kind of cars they had and did that kind of investigating, but they didn't do that. The other thing that happens is they test fire all of the rifles three times except for one, and one of them they test fire six times. They don't collect these spent bullets and shell casings and catalog them into evidence. They just get rid of them. Yeah, they could have easily taken a shell casing because they weren't having to log it into evidence and just plant it at the farmhouse. They could do that.
They also destroy a lot of evidence that's collected from the scene later on.
135 exhibits were destroyed in 1973.
Yeah. On these rifles, the 64 rifles that you were talking about that they collected and they were test firing, I'm thinking, well, who cares if this shell matches or doesn't match? What's the rifling say on these bullets collected? And does the rifling match Arthur's .22 rifle? Because if that's the case, then I don't care about this shell in the garden. Depending on who you listen to, which expert, da-da-da-da-da, one will say the bullets recovered from the victims do match the rifling marks that the barrel of Arthur's rifle would leave. Others say it absolutely does not. Now, the rifling in a barrel is planes of steel that are twisted. Now, they're either twisted to the right or they're twisted to the left. And then there's, of those planes, you have between 4 to 6, depending on the rifle, all that. They were able to identify how many planes the barrel should have had and which way it was twisted. And they're saying that it doesn't match his rifle. If nothing else, the bullets that they recovered from the victims are inconclusive to his rifle. You cannot say one way or another because there just wasn't enough of the bullet left. But you can say that they had the number 8 stamped on them, which says they're from a different batch, which does not match the casing that was found in the garden. The planes that they refer to, at least in the commission report, are typically lands and grooves that we refer to as in America. Again, these are just twisted flat steel going down the barrel is what gives the bullet the spin. Think of a quarterback throwing a football. The more spin you have, the more stability you have, and the straighter the bullet goes. But different styles of weapon have different grooves, and they leave different markings on a bullet. They really can't say if the bullets recovered came from his gun. At that point, I don't care about the shell in the garden anymore. It's inconsequential.
Yeah, the bullet recovered from Jeanette was more intact than the fragments recovered from Harvey. But it's still not enough for, I don't think, anyone to come along and say, we know it came from this weapon definitively. All they can say is it's possible.
Now, Hutton, to his dying day, says he absolutely did not plant any evidence. And his daughter is even out there trying to clear his name, because any news article you read says cop who planted the evidence. I mean, it's really bad. Maybe he didn't plant this. If what these two officers, you know, these two investigators that found the shell, if what they say is true, that it was 2 to 3 inches into the dirt, that doesn't sound like it was there for 3 months. That sounds like it had settled there for a long period of time.
Well, but they say they were able to show that that casing was fired from his rifle.
Yeah. They checked the hammer mark on it, the firing pin mark, all these things. And it was the brand that he owned at his house. In the commission report, and it is funny because the news headlines say police admit to planting evidence. But in the commission report, it actually says it is more plausible that this was planted than it was not. But they never come out and say, yeah, we planted evidence. That you're never going to find a commission report or any sort of report on any kind of investigation that straight up says that.
I think it's because they say the reason they didn't prosecute anyone in the department for planting evidence was because they couldn't show or prove who could have done it or who would have done it. They have suspicions. They don't have anything definitive enough to take someone in law enforcement to court over this.
Yeah, I mean, they keep saying Hutton, but we don't know. I mean, if let's say an officer did plant it, was it him or was it the guys that found it?
Right. They could have been like, we've been out here almost 2 hours. Let's just get done with this crap.
They want a shell. We'll give them a shell.
A review reveals as much that Hutton may have been under a lot of pressure. There were several high-profile murders at the time that he was having to oversee the investigations of them.
So spread a little thin, then.
That's what they're saying, but I don't know that it's acceptable to people. And this is your job.
Yeah, and this is a very high-profile case because double murders don't happen in farming communities up in this region. It's just not that common.
What we're left with here is this man was twice convicted and then pardoned. And when he was pardoned, the prime minister at the time was Sir Robert Muldoon. He was told, don't pardon him. This is the quote, you would make a mockery of our system of justice. I think it was brave of the prime minister to pardon Arthur Thomas. You had this well-respected couple murdered in their own home. He was going to say that the person that was not convicted just once, but convicted twice of the crimes was going to be let go. And then later, of course, he would be paid what amounts to $1 million. It had to have been a very controversial decision. But when you go through the evidence and you see that the police weren't recording things very well, they weren't corroborating statements, they weren't doing enough investigating. In fact, it was described in a review as them going from their gut instinct. And that's why they focused on Demler first, because he just sent weird signals to them. And then after that, because of the shooting deaths that they discovered, oh, wait, maybe it was someone else. Oh, wait, maybe it's Arthur Thomas, because he's the one who possibly owned the axle that was found to be with Harvey's body in the water. You hear all the time, police had tunnel vision. They only focused on this person. Well, in this case, it wasn't just tunnel vision. It was poor recording. It was poor documentation. And if you want to get into all these reports, you can read them. And there are hundreds of pages. And you can see just how they didn't write things down. They didn't take very good notes. And so what you're left with is a very good possibility that they fired a shell, took the shell casing and planted it in the garden and found it later, mysteriously, to frame a man who may or may not have been guilty. But when it comes down to it, when you have a planting of evidence and you don't have a clear motive and you can't show that this wiring is definitely that wiring and that the axle was in his possession, it all becomes gut instinct. And that's not good enough to convict a man. And in this case, he spent 9 years in prison before he was let go.
They say it's going to make a mockery of the justice system if they pardon him. It's always humorous for me to hear when judges, prosecutors, or anyone that's in charge says we can't go back on this because it'll make a mockery of our system. And I think it actually reinforces with the public that you're doing the right thing. And it tells us that you are willing to check yourself, error correct along the way. I like to see this. I don't even know if Arthur's innocent or guilty, but the investigation proves that it wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt.
The crew's daughter, Rochelle, 2010, she's the one that pushed and got a review done of this investigation. And in the end, the review seemed to clear her grandfather, Len Demler, of being involved in the murders, which, of course, pleased her. But it seemed to reinforce the idea that, to this day, the police believe that Arthur Allen Thomas is the likely killer of Harvey and Jeanette Crewe, which yes. I think is like a jab in his direction. Yeah, you beat us, but we're going to stick it to you one more time. And it just gives more weight to the decision that the Prime Minister, Sir Robert Muldoon, had to make back in 1979.
Yeah, the Thomas family felt that this reinvestigation was whitewashed. And their quote is, "We've been cheated. The facts haven't come out. They haven't moved on from 1970.
Pat Booth, the investigative journalist, he was asked about this. Should they reopen the case? Obviously, they don't have the killer to this day. How are we going to bring justice to this family or families? And Pat Booth said there's no reason to reopen it because he feels that they were able to clear Arthur Allen Thomas's name. Pat Booth goes on to say that he believes that Jeanette killed her husband and then killed herself days later.
And then wrapped him up, zombied, and went to the river?
No, I think the theory is that Len Demler would have moved the bodies, but move Jeanette, maybe he could do it, but no one, I don't really think anybody believes that Len Demler could have moved Harvey Crewe. He was just a little too big.
Moved him by himself. He would have had to have had help.
You know, we talked before about motive, and you don't have to always have a motive, but I think in a case like this where people said that Arthur Thomas had, you know, a crush on Jeanette and wanted her and she had rebuffed him, there is nothing that I could find that supports this idea that Harvey and Jeanette would have killed each other.
The murder-suicide thing, yeah.
Yeah, nothing supports that. If we're going to go off the deep end there, I mean, you might as well be ready to believe all the other crazy theories that the police came up with and couldn't support. So in the end, how do you sum up this case, Justin?
I went into it thinking this guy was guilty. And even in the face of a lot of the issues, it wasn't until I figured out the problem with the shell casing in the garden that I had my aha moment and decided, okay, yeah, no, this is a bad investigation. And I don't know if they were framing him because I don't assume malice when incompetence is so prevalent in today's world. Do I think that Lynn did this? Do I think that Rasmussen did this? Flip a coin. Rasmussen was kind of technically the last guy with the access to the axle, in my mind. Or Lynn could have gone over there to Arthur's, got the axle because it's so much land. If he knew where it was, then he could have done that. But that seems a little far-fetched unless he'd gotten it prior to the murders. Because why would he go over there and risk being seen to get this piece of metal? He could have weighed these bodies down with anything. I don't think Arthur was the killer, but I understand why the police might have gone for him and decided that he was a prime suspect. When the evidence falls apart, I don't have much of an opinion anymore. And the police won't go back and reinvestigate because most of the evidence has been destroyed. You can't go back and interview key witnesses from 40 years prior. It's done. You cannot solve this crime at this point.
Yeah, the question for me was, were the prior incidents involving the burglary and the arsons, were those related to the murders? And I kind of think they were.
Yeah, building up of conflict.
I would say that because of the poor investigation, that what we're left with is an unsolvable murder at this point. It wouldn't be fair of me to start pointing fingers and guessing who I think killed anyone, because there's too much room here for fabrication of evidence. And I know we have other cases where police have been accused, but to me, this is worse because they had in their possession a rifle and ammunition that they could have used to plant this shell casing. And they could have done so and no one would be the wiser. And the only reason they were able to figure it out is because of Pat Booth and Jim Sprott. Some of the problems with the investigation. The crime scene was poorly preserved. Many people went through. One detective even left his notebook on top of a table. Cars were parked on the front lawn for the first day. There were things seen in photographs but not taken into evidence, one of which was an oil skin. They don't know if it had any bearing on the investigation or the crime or anything, but it wasn't taken into evidence, so they don't know. The front of the house was given priority and not the rear. They know now that they should have focused on the rear of the house. Fingerprinting evidence, evidence seizure, photography, all of that was affected adversely, they say, because they were taking a lot of items from what amounted to the wrong part of the house if they were looking for evidence. And fingerprint identification, just poorly documented. This evidence was not secured either. They don't have good records of who had what at what times, and it makes for a very bad investigation. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.